Right on. This is how we get down Saturday night, oh, yeah. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A blast from the past, salt and pepper. Oh, yeah.
David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features P. Saineth, Gagging Democracy, India Style. India, the world's most populous country, is ruled by Narendra Modi, who is the head of the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP. He first became prime minister in 2014 and has been re-elected twice since, though in 2024 with much lower margins. Before coming to power in Delhi, he was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, where he presided over a major massacre of Muslims. Modi and the BJP promote Hindutva, Hindu majoritarianism. It is laced with Islamophobia. Modi is allied with India's billionaire class, who control the country's major media and function as cheerleaders for a regime that gags democracy, free speech, and dissent. Our guest today is P. Saineth. He's an award-winning journalist who writes about rural India. "I cover the people," he says, "who live at the bottom end of the spectrum." He's the founding editor of PARI, the People's Archive of Rural India. He gave the Harish Sharma Memorial Lecture at the Surrey Public Library in Surrey, British Columbia, in early October. And now, P. Saineth, Gagging Democracy, India Style.
A few months ago, just before the national elections, our Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, discovered and declared that he had understood after his mother's passing that he was not biologically born. Yeah? And had in fact been installed by God to show all the rest of us whatever he has been showing us. So, when we are talking about governance by gagging, and I'm going to race a bit, there are many, many ways in which a society is gagged. And one of them you saw immediately after that wonderful statement of the Prime Minister. Not a single newspaper wrote a single editorial, not a single anchor on any channel made any kind of critical comment when the head of the nation says that he is non-biologically born. You know, it's just as if they didn't hear it. He said it out loud and clear. The gagging is of a particular, of one of the five types that I'm going to talk about. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra-legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media, which, like in the case of the prime ministers, not biologically born and of divine origin. I mean, I think there were at least some interesting doctrines to be gone into when you are of divine origin. Then there is the fourth, that is the gagging that comes with big money and huge inequality, which to my mind is the main source of the gagging, because it didn't just start on 2014 with Mr. Modi. That's not true. That's not accurate. You know, it's been going on. It's raced in the time of Mr. Modi. But ever since we embraced neoliberalism in 1991, the different sources of gagging have grown immeasurably. And the last is the gagging by self-censorship. The fear. How many people who know better are remaining silent because it's bloody prudent and sensible to remain silent. Okay, so those are broadly the five ways. Let me show you the first, gagging by laws. And, you know, one of the ways of silencing people is that it requires just the selective silence of the judiciary. Would you believe that the Delhi High Court has held that Inqilab Zindabad is an incendiary and inflammatory statement, and you can go to jail for it if they feel that you used it in a violent context. Inqilab Zindabad, coined by Maulana Hasrat Mohani, was the rallying cry of the Indian freedom struggle. Long live the revolution. Here is the Delhi High Court. This is in the case of poor Umar Khaled. Umar Khaled has been denied bail I don't know how many times. And one of his problems, of course, is that he has a Muslim name. That's a serious issue and indicative, doubtless, of criminality. So look at what they're saying here. Huh? During the course of argument, issues were raised relating to the content, context, and use of certain phraseology in the speech of the appellant. This is the High Court of Delhi, which prima facie appeared to be incriminating per se, as also as inflammatory. The court goes on to say, however, this court is not impressed by the argument of the appellant, inasmuch as the call to revolution does not have to effect only the immediate gathering. The call to revolution may affect many beyond those who were visibly present, which is why this court finds it apt to mention Robespierre, who was in the vanguard of the French Revolution. This court is of the view that possibly, if the appellant had referred to Maximilien Robespierre for what he meant by revolution, he must have also known what revolution meant for our freedom fighter and first prime minister. The very fact that Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru believed that democracy had made revolution superfluous. By the way, Nehru used that slogan many times himself in the 30s. That democracy has made revolution superfluous after independence, and how it meant to the complete opposite of a bloodless change. Revolution isn't by itself always bloodless, which is why it is contradistinctly used with the prefix of bloodless revolution. So when we use the expression revolution, it is not necessarily bloodless. They're finding a way to say that Umar Khaled's slogan, Inqilab Zindabad, which is in every Indian trade union meeting that you can imagine at the beginning and at the end, was somehow an incitement to violence. A revolution in its essential quality may not be different, but from the point of view of Robespierre and Pandit Nehru, in its potentiality, blah, blah. The accompanying documents, and in view of the discussions herein, only for the limited percent of the present bail, this court expresses the inescapable conclusion that allegations against the appellant are prima facie true. And hence, the embargo created by section whatever of the UAPA is the most draconian of laws, Unlawful Activities Prevention Act in India. under which they brought to this horrible law of 1967, they brought amendments in 2019 which enable the police to charge or government to characterize an individual as terrorist. That was actually meant for organizations. They can now term anyone, an individual, a terrorist. And like they have with Umar Khalid and others. Thus, the appellant's application seeking regular bail is rejected. Did you ever believe that in your lifetime that a court would say Inqilab Zindabad is incriminatory and inflammatory? So there you are with this incredible situation where hundreds of people are arrested arbitrarily. They don't get bail. Meanwhile, when someone else comes up who is not objectionable to the government, the court issues bail with pious injunctions like bail is the rule, jail is the exception. A Supreme Court judge has gone on record saying that in the UAPA, jail is the rule, bail is the exception. On October 3, we observed the first anniversary of the biggest raid on journalists in Indian history. There was much worse done to journalists under colonial rule, and there were a lot of terrible things done to journalists during the political emergency of 75-79. But it never happened. It never happened that 46 journalists associated with a single publication in a single city were raided by nearly 500 policemen at dawn. This was the journalists associated with NewsClick. Also, every electronic device they owned was confiscated. Some of them have still not got it back. Hard disks, laptops, mobile phones, the whole works. And the courts did not raise a finger to protest against this. Yeah. So there you have one very clear form of gagging. If you look at this, the court holds that the Delhi police charge of terrorism against Umar Khalid are prima facie true. And therefore, there is no way it will give him bail. This is the High Court of Delhi. In the emergency, you know, every year, every June 25th, all over India, we have commemorative meetings to remember the declaration of the emergency, June 25, 1975, and that we shall never have it again. Now, the tragedy with this, as much as I attend those meetings and make speeches at them myself, the tragedy is every day, that every year, that single day, we ritualize our remembrance of the emergency. Every year, on that single day, we ritualize our rejection of the emergency. But almost every day, every year since, we institutionalize our embrace of it through new laws, through amendments, like the unlawful activities public. So we've rebuilt emergency in far more lethal form through a number of little laws and amendments and stuff. Yeah, some of which I'll come to when we come to corporate media and how the government works in sync with it. What do we mean by governance, by gagging? We have seen the laws. By the way, governance is no longer refers to governments alone. There are many other institutional players in governance. There is corporate governance. There's all sorts of... I will only look at these five which I have told you about. But I want to also say that there is a very brave, feisty, combative, independent media in India. But their size is restricted. Their support is restricted. They have no revenues to speak of. And yet, you know, we hear about all the doctrines of journalism and what we are supposed to do. I have come to hate this cliche, speaking the truth to power. I really hate it. you know, somehow it's such a wimpish little thing. As if power is so naive, poor things, it's just that they don't know what's right. Yeah, and if we talk to them the truth to power, they will set everything right. Power knows much better than any one of us what's going on. When much of what is going on the way it is because power wants it to happen that way. Okay? My exhortation to all of you, if it pleases you, by all means speak the truth to power. A lot of journalists fancy themselves as advisors to prime ministers and things. By all means, if it pleases you, speak the truth to power. The far more important thing every citizen has got to do, especially the media, speak the truth about power. Speak the truth to people about power. So we come to the gagging in the second form, the violence, the illegal, the extra-legal gaggings that go on. And the best example, on which I don't have to even say more, once I tell you the word, Manipur. The kind of violence in Manipur, the incredible bloodshed, not even your prime minister has not visited once in a year. I think that the advisors look around for, on the map, on the globe, is there any country or island he has not yet visited? But so that he can go there, you know, and open a temple or something. But he hasn't made a visit to Manipur to condole with the people of Manipur who have lost how many lives we don't know, apart from God knows some 200 churches or something burned down or demolished or damaged. That kind of violence, and the kind of violence unleashed by the frontal organizations of the ruling party. And in fact, I promised a friend here that I would dwell on this point a little bit, because people always ask me, I get emails, etc. When you talk about the violence by the VHP, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, or the Bajrang Dal, or anyone else, very often the BJP response is, they are not part of the BJP. They are fraternal friends or whatever, but we don't know. I mean, we don't speak for them, except when what they've done is something that the BJP takes credit for. So I keep getting asked this question, is there no difference between the RSS, BJP, VHP, Bajrang Dal? Is there a difference? I believe there's a very serious difference. The RSS is the mothership. The BJP is the RSS on politics. The VHP is the BJP on steroids. And the Bajrang Dal is the VHP on crack. Big difference. Huge difference. This is the difference in the Parivar frontal organizations, etc. Incidentally, the last speech at which I said this, that disappeared from the internet. And what a horrible term the media use when they are demolishing the houses of poor people in Ayodhya, elsewhere, mostly Muslims, but also others, including in Ayodhya, it includes a number of Hindus, because that's becoming a real estate scam. And rich people from Delhi are investing a lot of money in land in Ayodhya, yeah, and making rentals and all that prohibitively expensive for locals, right? So the extent of these demolitions, the media calls it bulldozer justice. And many progressives use this term. There can be no connection between bulldozing a poor person's home and the word justice. What this is bulldozer terror. It is terrorism, it is bulldozer terror, and it is state-driven bulldozer terror. Okay. The Supreme Court has finally, after sitting like a sphinx on the issue for I don't know how long, said that there will be no further demolitions anywhere in the country except without its being referred to this court. Very nice. And yesterday another bench of them said that the demolitions going on in one particular part of India are exempted because we're not going to give a stay order on the lower court's permission for the demolitions, whatever. Selective silence of the judiciary is all that's required. Having made a great pronouncement and congratulated in the newspaper editorials for stopping, saying no more of this, after hundreds if not thousands of homes of people not aligned with the ruling party have suffered from that. And again, at every stage, in both the first two categories that I spoke to you about, you see how critical the role of the media is. The media that accepted blandly our Prime Minister's divine origin, the same media never said a word in 2015. Barely a year after he assumed power, he inaugurated the Reliance Health Foundation, where he made this absolutely phenomenal speech. I did not see editorials criticizing it either, where he declared that ancient India 20, 30, God knows how many thousand years ago, obviously knew plastic surgery. Otherwise, how do you explain the elephant head on Ganesha's body? Okay? This is the Prime Minister of India. And you remember, we are the greatest in everything. Now, the newspapers reported it. Please, you can just Google it and see. Newspapers reported it. Independent media criticized it, ridiculed it, to no avail. Yeah, at one level, it is a never-ending source of entertainment. But when you got to live with it and take the consequences of it, it becomes a gagging when nobody speaks up. Another question people ask me is, who is your first hero in journalism? My first hero in journalism was the kid who said, hey, the emperor is stark naked. Now, what he said was already in the public domain. Yeah? But the courtiers were busy explaining, understanding that the gold weave was so fine that it was not visible to the human eye. And that was my first hero in journalism. The kid who said the emperor is naked. Yeah? How much we need kids like that. You're not going to find them in the corporate media, which has been... Now look at the strength and power of this corporate media. The Indian corporate media, meaning its corporate ownership, the bulk of circulation, the bulk of channels, everything are corporate owned. And these corporations are into hundreds of different areas of manufacturing, production, trade, etc., which give rise to unimaginable levels of conflict of interest. So you've just got absolutely no control on what you don't, we don't have, even in the United States, they have laws on cross-ownership, which are easily broken ever since Reagan came to power. But there were laws on cross-ownership. You could not be the only game in town, only newspaper, only portal, only radio station, only TV station in town. You could not be. So what you did was went and had mergers somewhere else so that you could still be. But at least there was a bloody law. We have no law against cross-ownership or anything of the sort. India's richest man is Mukesh Ambani, the 12th richest man in the world or whatever. So Mukesh Ambani, he had a wedding for his son, including the prequel, sequel, and all that. It cost more than $500 million. And that wedding was held in a state of Maharashtra where many suicides of farmers are linked to the inability of the family to conduct their daughter's wedding. Okay? I've done stories on that. Yeah? And in that state, you hold this wedding with, you know, an 800-pound gorilla wedding. When the farm agitation took place, did your media ever tell you that this was the largest struggle for justice on the face of the earth in 30 years? peaceful, constitutional, legal, democratic protest. Yeah? Let me take another struggle whose idealism I admired and respected and still do in North America. In 2011, you had the Occupy Wall Street movement where thousands of very idealistic youngsters, many of them techies, occupied Zuccotti Park in New York. They had a fantastic impact and they coined one of the greatest slogans, 1% versus the 99%. It had an impact across the United States. More than 400 towns had similar sit-ins, you know, Occupy Atlanta, etc. Many people being evicted by their councils got support locally in different small American cities to occupy the properties and not be thrown out, not be evicted. All this is great. And it got a phenomenal amount of publicity because it was there in Wall Street. Though, by the way, for the first 2 weeks, as it began to unfold, the New York Times simply ignored it. They said very little about it. Yeah. Anyway, at the end of 9 weeks, the mayor of New York told the NYPD, throw the scumbags out. In hours, NYPD cleared Zuccotti Park. In 24 hours, there was no trace of the agitation. In India, 100,000 farmers gathered at the gates of Delhi from Punjab, from Haryana, and some representation from 20 other states. They gathered at Delhi. They were met with a violence that you would not believe. The Border Security Force, the CISF, Central Industrial Security Force, the CRPF, the Punjab Police, the Delhi Police, the Haryana Police, all of them. Do you know what the government of India did? It broke its own laws on destruction of public property, whereby if you go around smashing things on the road or the lights, you'll be put in jail and charged a gigantic fine. To stop the farmers from entering Delhi, they dug 20-foot by 10-foot trenches in the national highways and then go to the court saying that the farmers are blocking traffic to Delhi. The farmers at the agitation were met with ice-cold water cannon in Delhi's worst winter in 40 years. One 78-year-old, one 80-year-old died of that within 3 days of being hit by icy-cold water cannon. Remember that these people were all sleeping in the open. The farmers were attacked with tear gas. Incidentally, this February 12th, look it up in your newspapers if you don't believe me, we're the first, right? We're the greatest, we're the best. We became the first nation to use drone warfare against our own farmers. Yeah? Spider drones, you know those things which have clasps, spider feet, carrying tear gas canisters, it was dropped on them, at the Punjab-Haryana border. Incidentally, one of them bounced off the head of a journalist and sent him to hospital. No protests in the media about that, but at least it was reported that this happened. Another journalist also got injured by the tear gas canisters. Now, all these methods of tear gas, you name it. Oh, they not only dug those giant trenches, they brought God knows how many kilometers of concertina wire. Do you know what concertina wire is? It's that barbed wire that opens out like an accordion. So you can stretch it across very large distances. Huge bales of concertina wire were opened. And with all this, they could not beat down those farmers. Those farmers remained there for 54 weeks until they threw the damn laws out. The farmers were scoring a significant victory against corporate media. Whatever happened there did not happen because brave journalists said things, though some of us were regular speakers at the camps. They built their own township, Singhu, Tikri. They built their own townships around Delhi and protested. You know, the enthusiasm it roused, 3,000 farmers went from Maharashtra to join them and opened their own camp at Shah Jahanabad the border of Rajasthan, Haryana, Shahjahanpur. So on one occasion, when some of us went around the Singhu camp, and there was a little group there that did a survey, 21 languages were spoken in that camp in Singhu. Of course, the maximum number were from Punjab and Haryana. They are approximately the closest states. Of course, there are going to be more from there than anywhere else. 2,000 came from Nashik, from just one union, the Kisan, All India Kisan Sabha. And you know what many of these volunteers from other states were doing? They were volunteering for kitchen duty. You can read all these stories in the one website that created a category just for protests, farmers' protests, People's Archive of Rural India. And you'll see little kids peeling peas in the Rajasthan camp, and little Fateh Singh, 3-year-old, peeling peas with his mom for the cooking in the Shahjahanpur camp. Not one newspaper, not one channel would even mention that the main slogans of the farmers were naming Mr. Ambani and the second richest Indian, Mr. Adani. You know, a lot of these Punjabis and farmers have a Fauji background. They conducted one operation and took out 150 cell towers of Ambani. That was reported in two paragraphs. It was a devastating blow to Jio. You know, oh, incidentally, Mr. Ambani's Jio mobile service was personally advertised by the Prime Minister. We woke up one morning to find Prime Minister's photograph and the Jio ad in one frame on the front page of every newspaper. You know, in Indian law, that is illegal. There is a Emblems and Symbols Act under which you cannot use the photos of the Prime Minister, the President, to advertise a product unless there is a prior permission from the highest levels. So I responded immediately saying, wonderful, now we can change the national exhortation from Jai Hind to Jio Hind. Yeah.
You're listening to P. Saineth, Gagging Democracy, India Style. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. We're online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Why would they not say a single word about Ambani or Adani in the media? Because Mr. Ambani is the largest owner of corporate media, and that media he does not own, he's the largest advertiser. So you're not going to screw around with him. Nor are you going to screw around with the government advertising, because that is the only source for many hundreds of newspapers in India during the COVID-19 pandemic. And there was one moment of brilliance in the reporting of pandemic in October 2021, when people started reporting the bank bodies piled up on the banks of Ganga, Sarayu, Satlej, etc. When that happened, suddenly cold turkey, it disappeared. It just disappeared. All the reporting disappeared. Because the government pulled government advertising from all the publications. One newspaper group went ahead called Dainik Bhaskar. They continued to report. They were 2 weeks into it. They were raided by every enforcement agency imaginable. So the Enforcement Directorate, the Intelligence Bureau, the Income Tax, the police, the customs, GST guys, everybody was there. To their credit, Dainik Bhaskar they took a huge beating and then had to soften down. They had no choice. Ernst & Young calculated India's media entertainment industry value at $28 billion in March this year. Yeah, out of which a gigantic share belong to Mr. Ambani. Now they're going about the listed companies when they're putting up these trades. A single transaction in April added 30% to the value. When Mr. Ambani and Reliance, his company, initiated a merger with Disney Hotstar worth $8.5 billion, which gives them 60% of streaming in India. 60% of all streaming in India is now the property of Ambani Disney, which have merged. Now, when you made this added $8.5 billion, it meant that the value of the Indian media industry went to $36 billion, out of which 30-35% is owned by one individual. I don't know, we have to calculate. Mr. Ambani has more TV channels than he knows, than he can name. The media are all sewn up, except for the very combative, brave individual journalists. One of the things that was fantastic about the election coverage, where all the media got it wrong, you know who got it right? The cutting edge of Hindi journalism today is appearing in young YouTubers in Uttar Pradesh. No money, no resources, but they did it. And that is one of the they are the throwback to one of the finest traditions of Indian journalism. You fight regardless. Yeah? And they told the truth. They spoke the truth about power. They did not even speak to power. They spoke to people, they spoke the truth about power. Oh, by the way, here's a very funny thing. There's a gigantic Indian website at the cost of 110 crores. That's 1,110 million rupees. Azadi Ka Amrut Mahotsav, where there are no photos of freedom fighters who are alive, but there are 1,000 photos of you know who. The same photo that you get on every COVID vaccination certificate. The same photograph that very possibly soon might be on every bus ticket. Oh, another thing about corporate media, your corporate media in North America. The farmers' protests were also cut badly because Google, Facebook, Twitter, they have admitted as much through whistleblowers and through their own selves in the hearings in US Congress that the largest number of takedowns and suspensions of accounts or killing of accounts, the request came from the government of India under Mr. Narendra Modi. Elon Musk, of course, had to make a great drama of it about how he told the Indian government, this is a very wrong thing. You're harming freedom of expression. But we did it anyway. Because Facebook, for instance, I think the biggest share of revenue from any one country that it draws is India. It's about the money. It's about corporate media. In fact, would you believe it? After a young 18-year-old girl was arrested, Disha Ravi, for her environmentalism and activism, the Delhi police issued a tweet thanking Google and Twitter for helping them in the matter of tracing the toolkit. So then PARI, People's Archive, my website, started growing. It doubled. It trebled. It trebled in because we were covering the farmers' web. Incidentally, we published in 15 languages. So it was delightful to watch retired brigadier generals and retired colonels sitting in Singhu looking at PARI on their cell phones or actually even on laptops or tablets. You'll see we've done stories from the camps. Now, suddenly, our growth stopped. Cold turkey it fell. What had happened? The government of India, we know, got Google to tweak its algorithm ever so slightly so that searches for farmers' protests fell 60%. So guys, you see how many ways of gagging there are. And then the most important of all of them, big money inequality. In India, in 1991, we did not have a single dollar billionaire. Actually, it took 5-6 years in the new economic policies in the neoliberal path to produce our first billionaire. By 2019, we produced 98. That means we produced new billionaires at the rate of one every 70 days. Okay, 98 across 20. Every 70 days, we minted a new billionaire. We rank number 3 in the Forbes list, even now. We rank number 3. There were some pretenders earlier, like Germany and Russia and all that. I mean, but who takes Russia seriously, right? Russians, damn it. Every 5 years, the Russians send half their billionaires to prison. We send ours to parliament. Mature democracy. Right? So we send ours to parliament. You can see them there. Jindal, the whole works. I mean, I can name 6 of them over there, over in parliament. So anyway, we got rid of all these pretenders. We still have a little matter of China to deal with. The 800-pound gorilla on the list is, of course, the United States. Then comes China, then comes us. The same country which ranks number 3 in the world in Forbes billionaires list ranks number 132 in the Human Development Index of the United Nations. Ranks 178 out of 180 nations in the Environmental Performance Index devised by Columbia and Yale. Ranks 159 in the World Press Freedom Index out of 180 nations. In the Environmental Performance Index in 22, until somebody botched it up really bad in another country, we actually managed to be 180 out of 180 in 2022. Since then, somebody did worse than us and allowed us to step up 2 notches in the ladder. We rank 111 out of 121 nations in the Global Hunger Index of IFPRI. And this is at the same time that the Prime Minister is making speeches about how India, he's the Vishwa Guru, remember, right? I call him that. I always address him as the Vishwa Guru. It somehow seems appropriately obnoxious. The Vishwa Guru is telling the world that India will solve the problems of global nutrition security. India leads the world in stunting and wasting. Wasting is by, you know, weight to height. Stunting is height to age group. So that's the wonderful thing, that we are solving the problems of the world but can't seem to shake off these tags ourselves. So the big money inequality, let me show you the kind of inequality. This is on, as of July 16, 2024, the cumulative wealth of India's 200 dollar billionaires is 974 billion US dollars. The Indian budget expenditure for 2023-24 was 45,562 billion US dollars. That means the cumulative wealth of our billionaires is 1.7 times greater than the entire budget of 1.4 billion human beings. That is 1.7 times Indian budget's expenditure, but the cumulative wealth of 200 individuals is 62 times India's agricultural budget. Talk about farm distress now. 62 times India's agricultural budget, which is 15.62 billion US dollars. You know what 200 or 215 now it is, I think, yesterday? 215 dollar billionaires. I said by 2019 we had accumulated 98. In the next 30 months, we crossed 200. You know when we added our highest number of dollar billionaires? First 12 months of COVID-19. And who were the largest group with the new billionaires? Pharma, health sector. Do you know that when I say Indian billionaires, what do you guys think? You think tech industry, high tech. They're number 3. Above them is manufacturing. Above manufacturing is healthcare sector. I never use that word. I call it health cash sector. You know, it's a health cash sector. And they had in 2022 twice the number of dollar billionaires that India's wanted tech industry had. IT had 16. These guys had 22. India's estimated budget, I've already given you. Ambani's personal, one individual, his net worth, 118 billion USD, is 7.5 times the expenditure on agriculture as stated in the budget. One individual. Mind you, for his son's wedding, the Indian Air Force was deployed to take over air traffic control at Jamnagar Airport. And Jamnagar Airport in 1 week was declared as an international airport. You know where bloody Jamnagar is? Then anyway, Mukesh Ambani's net worth is actually in rupees, it's 9.8 trillion Indian rupees. Now, you know, one of the things that I intended to do was to study the promise of capitalism. What does capitalism tell us, guys? It tells us that if you work as hard as Ambani, you can also do it. Now, I've had theoretical problems with that. So, well, the theoretical problem simply is, if hard work makes you a billionaire, every woman in rural India would be a billionaire. And every woman in rural Africa, rural Latin America would be a billionaire if hard work makes you a billionaire. But since they are not, you need to question the validity of that, of capitalism's great promise. You work hard, you'll also be a billionaire. I think I work terribly hard. I work 18 hours a day. And I'm nowhere near to being 1/10 of a millionaire. Anyway, never mind. Okay. So this kind of inequality feeds into all those other gaggings. By the way, do you know how many 200 billionaires are in a population of 1.4 billion? They are 0.00014% of the population, controlling a wealth equivalent between 1/4 and 1/5 of our gross domestic product. Bringing to your mind that whole other meaning of the word gross. Forget the economists. I found that the best description of the mindset of inequality came from a woman I understand who is paralyzed and laid up and is not active anymore, but her Instagram post explained inequality better than the mindset of inequality better than any philosopher or economist I know. And this is what she said. If a monkey hoarded more bananas than it could eat, while most other monkeys starved, scientists would study that monkey to figure out what the heck was wrong with it. When humans do it, we put them on the cover of Forbes. All these things feed back into the gagging. The wealth, the inequality. You know what? One of the common techniques, we have imported it from the United States, is the slap strategy. The legal strategy of, you guys know what the slap strategy is? Okay, you don't. Slap is strategic litigation against public participation. So I intimidate you by putting a $100 million legal suit against you. Just give you an example. Intercept, which has done some of the finest exposes of the New York Times and others when it comes to Gaza and Palestine. Intercept has twice been sued by billionaires. They've won the both cases and they are $500,000 poorer. In slap strategy, you win the case, you still lose the case. Because we are all small units, small outfits. My friend Paranjoy Guha Takurta has been hit for 100 crores, 50 crores by Ambani, by Adani, all of them. It paralyzes you. And all the time you're running from one court to another. So please, this is just the crudest level at which it feeds in. Then the same 200 guys own your media. They're able to do anything in the law courts. Can I go up against the highest paid lawyers in Asia? You can't. You don't have that capacity. You are gagging through law, gagging through outlaws and violence. You're gagging through corporate media. You're gagging through big money and inequality. And finally, the gagging comes to self-censorship. In 2020, India had fallen to rank 142 in the World Press Freedom Index. The Vishwa Guru was outraged. Of course, there's got to be some fraud, jealousy. These Westerners are all jealous. India is overtaking USA and everybody else. So they're all jealous and they're all conspiring. So the government of India, the senior most officer of government of India, the Union Cabinet Secretary, that is the Badshah of bureaucrats, ordered, you know how important the Union Cabinet Secretary is? Theoretically, he takes his orders only from one man. So the Union Cabinet Secretary ordered the Information Broadcasting Ministry to set up a committee, independent committee, index monitoring cell, to respond to Reporters Sans Frontiers, which runs the World Press Freedom Index. By the way, I'm not obsessed with the world, with Reporters Sans Frontiers and their index either. But when you claim that it's false, why don't you create your own index and see? Now, I'm not impressed with Reporters Sans Frontiers, their performance on index on Gaza and Palestine. I'm not impressed at all what they've done. But the fact is that they put India at that stage at 142. So a big committee was formed, 13-member committee, full of very powerful people. Yours truly was one of only, actually it was only bureaucrats. Then some mischievous bureaucrat, well-meaning mischievous bureaucrat, told them, you know what, if it's going to be a committee dealing with press freedom, it might be an idea to have a journalist or two. So someone said, that's a good idea. And they got in touch with two of us. The other one I will not name, but is a very famous TV anchor, and you can easily figure it out. What happened to him? He attended 4 hours or two meetings. Have you guys ever heard of a TV anchor who online remained silent for 5 minutes? He remained silent for 4 hours. He did not say a word in either meeting. At the beginning of the third meeting, he got on to apologize to all of us, saying that his duties were onerous and he could not keep up with this. So I was left as the only journalist in the pot. Then the powers got worried about that. Since they'd lost a heavyweight, they brought on two middleweights, neither of whom any one of us in the journalistic circles had ever heard of before, but were obviously from the Sangh Parivar. Anyway, they also kept quiet. In every meeting, I didn't tell them why, but I was intervening and speaking up loudly, clearly in every meeting because this was COVID, right? It was all online. It was on Zoom. The reason I did that because I was recording every word. And anyway, at the end of it, they sent out a draft report. I protested about everything. And these are very experienced bureaucrats. They don't fight with you. Anything I said, he would turn to his secretary and say, Mr. Sainath has made a very important point. It should be noted. He knew and I knew that what was noted, he had done the dance before and so had I. We knew the steps, right? So anything I said, he said, very important point. I said, this methodological thing is wrong. Very important point. And of course, the draft report came. The notable thing about the draft report was that it never contained the word draft. Which meant that they were going to... Now, how did they intend to get it past me? The first line of the acknowledgement is effusive praise for yours truly. Don't ever say no to applause, okay? They thought that I'll read those lines and I'll let the report go. Can you imagine a 45-page report on press freedom that did not use the word dissent? That did not use the word censorship. 19 words I listed. None of these words appeared in the report, but they were. I wrote an independent note, still trying to get it in rather than confront. No response. I sent the note 3 times. High-powered government committee vanished. I sent it one more time. The email ID vanished. And this was about press freedom and freedom of expression. So guys, this is how it all works in. The inequality works in, the power works in, the judiciary works in, the executive works in. These were the 5. Now, the counter to this is, I can give 3 examples, inspiring ones. One, the small level fight back by independent journalists and independent media. I won't exaggerate our power. And they can squash us at any time they choose. They'll screw us up in many different ways, as they screw me up in many different ways by scaring donors away from my website. Just before COVID and during COVID, 2 great things happened. In 2019, tens of thousands of young teenaged kids often collected outside the gates of their hundreds of colleges and read out the preamble of the Indian Constitution while opposing the CA, the Citizenship Act amendment. It was so pleasing. It was so lovely to see teenage kids, some of them my students, I'm very proud to say, all of them reading out the preamble of the Indian Constitution. Justice for all, social, economic, political. I went very often to see and I would spot my students. And of course, I would tell them, that's lovely, you're reading the preamble. There's a little more stuff in the Constitution that's also interesting. And if you read, which may not be on WhatsApp, you know, maybe you take a look at the Constitution. But anyway, to give them credit, they did something that brought tears to my eyes. It was a signal, for me, that was a continuation of the spirit of the freedom struggle.
Dr. Sainath.
You were just listening to P. Sainath, Gagging Democracy, India Style. He spoke in Surrey, British Columbia in early October. P. Sainath is an award-winning journalist who writes about rural India. He's the founding editor of PARI, the People's Archive of Rural India. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, P. Sainath, Gagging Democracy, India Style, and for Arundhati Roy's latest book on India, The Architecture of Modern Empire, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Harinda Mahil. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar virtuoso Sharmista Sen performing Raga Kedara.
Hi, you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to Ebony Spectrum. Here are some of the things that you missed last week from some of our media partners.
Mr. Kennedy, I was struck by your comments during our meeting last week.
What?
I was struck by your comments in our meeting last week, where you made it abundantly clear to me that you intended to clean house of the professional scientist at the National Institutes of Health, which you know is headquartered in the state of Maryland and employs thousands of hardworking Marylanders. I, for the record, believe in scientists and I believe in doctors and I trust them over politicians without medical degrees. You talked about bad science and bad scientists. And in fact, you specifically said to me in response to my question that you intend to replace the bad scientist with the good scientist. And so I want to ask you, in your opinion, what makes a scientist or a doctor qualified to serve at the National Institutes of Health?
A scientist who's devoted to empirical methodology, to evidence-based science, a scientist who understand the importance of replication, importance of publishing raw data and being open and transparent about it, the importance of publishing peer review. We have NIH has overseen over the past several years the decline, the precipitous decline in American health. There's 91,000 people at HHS, and are you suggesting that some of them should not be held responsible for that decline? They were in charge of protecting our health.
Let me just say this, because I only have 3 minutes left. I don't set the rules here, but I ask the questions. And the question is really whether you intend, as you said, to substitute essentially your judgment for the judgment of these professional scientists.
I'm not going to substitute my judgment for science. Of course, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do, listen, the New York Times just did an article last week talking about the fraud, the 20-year fraud, 800 fraudulent studies produced by NIH on amyloid plaques and not allowing any other hypothesis about the cause of Alzheimer's.
Well, how will you decide, Mr. Kennedy, which scientists? Are they the ones who disagree with you?
The ones who are corrupt. The ones who have been doing science like the amyloid plaque studies that were fraudulent.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have a medical degree?
Do I? No.
Okay, let me go to the next question. The Heritage Fund has compiled a watch list of federal employees to go after federal staff. Is there a watch list for federal staff at HHS?
Not that I know of.
Have you or has anyone in the administration developed a list of career scientists or federal staff that you would target for termination?
Not that I know of.
And let me just ask you another question. Now, your failed presidential campaign has been raising money to try and cover your debts. And you were questioned about this yesterday and failed to answer a question that Senator Warren